Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 166. My name is Scroobius Pip. Thank you for tuning in. This week I am joined by the amazing Aislinn B. This was a great conversation. It wasn't the first time we've met, but it's the first time we've had a proper chatter, and it was absolutely lovely. I could have listened to her talk for hours on end. It was a wonderful chat. Before we get into that, though, thank you all for tuning in last week. Amazing reaction to possibly the most excited I've been in an episode. The most sad at the beginning, as I told my tale of heartbreak in the intro, but then the most excited when I was talking to Rebecca and Melanie from Ben & Jerry's and the IRC. So that was hugely exciting. A lot of you have been tweeting Ben and Jerry's to tell them that you want them to make the ice cream flavour I came up with live on the podcast. Tweet away. I think the more pressure that they get, the better. I think that's a great ice cream flavour. And I want to see my smiling bearded face in the middle of Ben and Jerry's smiling bearded faces on a tub. Unlikely, though, isn't it? But yeah, fun anyway. Things I have to tell you about this week. Today, oh my good lord. I'm recording this intro the week before this podcast came out, and I've recorded three in this last week, so there's some really good ones to come. Next week I've got Will Poulter on, who's in a great film at the moment called Detroit. He was also in Revenant, Maze Runner, tons of amazing things, Son of Rambo way back in the day. But yeah, anyway, what I was about to tell you about was, today, as this comes out, my new range of trainers is launched, and this is a massive deal for me. I designed some trainers last year with Who Shoes, some boots, and they sold out in the pre-order period, which was insane. So they decided they were up for working with me again, and we sat down and came up with two men's designs and two women's designs, because last time we didn't come up with any women's designs. So yeah, it's kind of exciting that it all launches today. I would have blasted it on my social media, no doubt. We did an amazing photo shoot. So on Instagram, if you follow me, you'll know every now and then I do one of them ridiculous multi-posts. I reckon I'm going to do one that's at least six images, because this photo shoot was amazing. It might be nine images, but yeah, you'll be able to find it all there or on the Who Shoes website. And it's OHW Shoes. It's Who backwards. So OHW. If you search all of that, you'll be able to find them. And hopefully you'll love them as much as I do, and you'll get your orders in. The other thing I have to tell you about, relevant, as I'm speaking to Aislinn B, and we talk about Ireland and Dublin, I'm coming to Dublin for a Distraction Pieces podcast live, and I'm very excited about this. I wasn't meant to be doing any this year, any live ones. I did about eight last year and a couple the year before, and I was taking a year off from them because I'm so busy. But the opportunity to do one in Dublin came about, and I could not resist that. So, yeah, grab your tickets. It's September 21st, I believe, at the Tivoli or Tivoli. Tivoli Theatre. Grab your tickets ASAP. Because the tickets are going well, we're trying to look at potentially doing a second night, a bonus night of something a bit different. I won't go into too much detail. It's basically, we're going to look at ticket sales in the next week or so, and then potentially add another little extra thing. Obviously, the Thursday night is going to be the main event. I've got, in general, at the live ones, I don't have guests. I sometimes have surprise guests. At the moment, I've got a fucking awesome surprise guest for Dublin. It may or may not happen, but I think it will, and it'll be amazing. So come along to that, basically. Thursday the 21st, please buy your tickets immediately for the Dublin podcast festival. And as I said, the more advanced sales we get, the more we can look at potentially doing a few extra bits while I'm over So swoop in and get involved. And wait, I mean, I should mention, the way the live ones work is, in general, you guys are the audience. Are the audience or the guest? So rather than just passing a mic out and you ask a question, I get a queue to form at the side of the stage. I have chairs and microphones on stage. And you come up and you can either ask a question or pick a subject you'd like to discuss or get my opinion on, or something you'd like to tell me about, a story you'd like to tell me. And we have a little moment and a little interaction, and the crowd are there and we record it. So yeah, I'm looking forward to that. I've always had great, like, post-gig in Ireland has always been the longest time spent on the merch table because of the conversations had. So I'm thinking that Dublin isn't going to be a problem to fill some time with some chatter and whatnot. So yeah, come along to that. Get your tickets now. Let's get on with the podcast, eh? At the end of the podcast, I'll tell you about a few of the ones that we've got in the pipeline. But for now, I normally mention it at the end, but in the first half, I'm going to mention the rest of the podcast on the network. A hardcore listing with Chris and Stu of the Drunk Cast has been amazing of late. They've had some amazing guests picking some amazing topics. The Brett Goldstein episode, picking his top five worst or most awkward comedy gigs, was genius. The Jordan Gray episode, picking her top five comedians, stand-ups, was a favourite. Ed, Chris's mate, was on there picking his top five drinks and his top five worst types of customer he served in the drinks, entertainment, club night, venue, bar industry. So that's hilarious. You'll relate to a lot of them. Yeah, in general, just check the boys out. It's a lot of fun. Then there's Tuesday Night Jaw. Oh, I'm glad I brought this one up, actually, because as this goes out, it's only a week or so away before we have Tuesday Night Jaw live. So I'm going to be joining Jim Smallman, along with the amazing Glenn Joseph and a load of others, at Tuesday Night Jaw live on September 8th in London. King's Place, I think. I might remember that wrong. But it's part of the London Podcast Festival. I believe it's at midday on the Saturday. So come along to that. It's the weekend of the huge Progress show at Ali Pali, which is sold out. But the live Tuesday Night Jaw podcast isn't. So I'll be on the panel and we'll be chatting and rambling on. So grab your tickets for that. And also always, of course, check out Stop and Search with Jason Reed. He had Marcus Brigstock on as a guest recently. It's a fantastic episode. And Say Why to Drugs with Dr. Susie Gage, which is the most successful podcast on the network outside of Distraction Pieces. And I think it'll overtake Distraction Pieces soon enough. So check that out. All great podcasts. But for now, this is episode 166 with Aislinn B. Actually, I'm going to turn it around because it should be that way.
Oh, with the red.
At the red dot, yeah.
Can you hear all that?
I can hear all that. And we've started. That's how we're starting. With you saying hello. That's a nice welcome, right?
Yeah.
I'm joined today, warmly in your living room, by Aislinn B. How are you?
I'm very good. You feel free to say that we've provided you with a free glass of water.
Yep, I have got a glass of water. It's the only reason I go in for auditions is because of the free glass of water. So I'm always like, yes, this is going
to
be great.
Time to hydrate.
I'm going to fill up. Yeah, exactly. How's it going? How are you?
I think I'm well enough.
You seem nice and busy.
Yeah, I've kind of come to the end very much this week of quite a busy period.
Yeah.
And by that, I don't mean like ladies. I mean a time of chunk of time. And so I feel a little bit more relaxed. I kind of tend to burn the candle quite a lot and then go, why did you do that? You really aren't well. And then get myself back.
Completely.
Into it.
It's one of the things when you're in any industry that kind of you are your job.
Yeah.
There is that natural thing of, oh, I need to just keep going. I need to keep going.
You don't know. You sort of have, a sort of nomadic quality to your life, and you're not sure whether when it might rain again in the desert. Yeah. So you try and farm a lot. Guys, we've got a farm. We don't know, next summer might have nothing.
I think it must be...
Big shout out to all the farmers who understand that metaphor there.
It's always reassuring to hear that's the case and the fear at every level of your career. Because the fact is, as said, and we'll get into loads of different things, but you have been really busy and there is a lot going on. But I love the idea that a Robert De Niro finishes a film and thinks, I wonder if there's going to be...
I wonder if anything else
is going to come in at the end of the month.
Most people during their formative career years spend more time worrying about money and whether it'll happen than... And that kind of forms their brain.
Yeah.
And so then when stuff starts coming in, you never think you're going to be that lucky for that to last forever. Yeah. And maybe until you get to such a level where... like 7 of your houses would have to burn down before you have nowhere to live that you might think to yourself, maybe I can chill out and enjoy this. So that's how I feel about with stuff. But you have to be careful not to enjoy any of it.
Yeah.
Which I sometimes get to. I'm like, no, just keep working.
On to the next thing. And again, there is, not to panic you, but there is a logic in it, in that it's not the kind of job that you have a pension and you have this and you have that. It's literally while you're working is... the only time you're earning. It's not, you've got sick leave, you've got this or that. It's like, while you're working, that's when you're getting paid. And as soon as you stop, you're not anymore.
Maybe if
you
were in something...
So you do kind of have to earn for your...
If you were in something in the 90s where the contracts, they didn't know that box sets and Netflix were going to take off.
Yeah.
So some people are in shows during the 90s, like The Office and stuff, and they still get royalties every time it's shown.
That's amazing.
But then they like locked down on that. But maybe if you were in one of those shows, you could relax because you're like, even if I never work again, that show keeps on getting shown on Dave.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know? Dave, they must have locked down on that, or Dave couldn't exist because it cost a fortune.
I feel
to
like everyone who was
shows.
On QI 10 years ago is probably still getting a bout of cash. Yeah. But every time there's a repeat one, something I'm on, I don't get any sweet cash from that.
Not a thing. That's outrageous. let's kind of go back to the start and your upbringing.
Were
you from in Ireland?
You can't even believe it. No shoes. Where am I from? I'm from Kildare in Ireland, which is a very horsey area.
Yes.
So I was surrounded by horses growing up. My mother is a retired jockey. My father was a horse vet. And very horsey. And all of the town was horsey.
I love how genuinely in Ireland, outside of Dublin and that, it is fields and country roads.
Yeah.
It's like the first time we toured out there, it would be like, at points, the sat nav would just be like, it's roughly that way. Aim you in that direction. And that's a wonderful thing, right? I mean, looking at it at a distance, how was that?
I suppose it was like if you grew up in a house in a town full of magicians, you'd be like, oh, magicians are so boring. If I have to see another bloody card trick, we can all do card tricks. That's how I felt about the sort of jockey and horses element.
Yeah.
And then once I went to university, especially once I moved to England, where horse racing is a very upper class thing.
Completely.
And in Ireland, it's a really working class thing. That and people like you were brought up around horse racing just felt like I just jumped out of a ditch and go, does anyone want a pint? I was raised on pints. I grew up in a ditch. so people seemed to feel like it was but I kind of forgot that it was special or weird in any way.
Yeah, that's a weird conflict, isn't it? Or comparison. It is, again, my upbringing. I wasn't near horses until I've done some things in acting.
I went out with a guy from Birmingham, and he was brought up in Birmingham City. And until he was 16, he'd never seen a cow up close.
That is amazing.
And he says he remembers when they brought this bus of Birmingham City kids out of the farm. They were all too scared to get off the bus because they thought the cows were going to eat them. And like on the way back, they had a McDonald's, and they were like, "You know, the cow you thought was going to eat you is in that burger. You are eating your enemy.
You're expressing your dominance over that."
He also thought that milking cows, when he saw them being milked, he was like, "Oh, so is milk cow wank?" That's what he thought it was. And you're like, it's not.
I mean, it's a beautiful thought, though, isn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that it would be one of the most popular drinks in the world.
Those cows are really not getting wanked, let me tell you that. That is not... I mean, if the dairy industry want to use that against vegans, it's not wanking.
Yeah,
it really isn't
quite.
Yeah.
So you came over to the UK for study?
Is that the case?
I was at university in Dublin and I was in a sketch group while I was at university. And then I got my heart broken and I was like, I'm never again going to perform a comedy at all. Thank you very much. I'm going to go to drama school in London and do monologues. And then when I get out of drama school, I had no agent. I had bleach blonde hair. And I was not immediately getting cast as Medea at the National Theatre of London.
Weird.
So I kind of ended up writing a lot and doing a lot of like comedy workshops and little kind of comedy things and then getting little comedy parts. Because the thing about comedy is people don't laugh at someone if they're not funny or they don't laugh at them just because they're famous. So in drama, people might look at you and put a load of music around you. And if you're not a good actor, you can kind of fake being good at dramatic acting. Because you look out a window, put a nice bit of Radiohead behind it, and all of a sudden people think you're having really deep thoughts. But you can't fake funny.
Yeah.
And people will watch a cat being funny on the on YouTube just as much as they will a really famous funny person doing all of their great stand-up on TV.
You see the mention of a cat being funny, funny made, me laugh, made me laugh. Genuinely made me laugh.
The first time I've seen you laugh since you've come into the house. I wish I wish you'd look at me, Pip. The way you looked into your mind at that cat.
That cat. I've got a mate who I wish someone would ever laugh at me the way he laughs at his own jokes.
Because
honestly is just I've never seen anyone so happy. He at points is mocking me and struggling to get the words out, even though there's just the two of us.
He finds himself
in
so
tears
funny.
Of laughter at what he's saying. It's like, well, good. Fair play to you.
I love that as a person. I hate watching people like that. It really makes me laugh. It's the most arrogant of all of the laughs.
It is, but it kind of it works as well because it gets people on board.
I
love Gervais, but I think part of the podcast thing was always the fact that he was in such tears of laughter at his own hilarity that I was brought along on that ride.
Yeah,
potentially. Oh, it's essentially you're bringing your own laughter track along with you, and people know. Like when to laugh then and when
I
to enjoy
it, I do wish
I
had that skill, actually, to find myself funny. I still can't understand it. That's maybe why I sort of burrow away and try to kind of like go, well, while the going's good, I seem to have tricked all of these people. because I don't, I'm not sure I'd be, I'm not sure I'd find myself funny.
But did you drift naturally into the comedy scene in the UK? Because it's interesting, because Dublin is, it's an amazing place for drama, for comedy, but it seems to there's so much that is just from Ireland for Ireland.
There's so
much
we're a
great
real
drama
small town.
And stuff like that that just stays there and literally never makes it into the UK or anywhere else. And it's weird. It wasn't until I was chatting with Aidan Gillen and hearing some of the roles he's played and some of the things he's done that I've never heard of. I was like, wow, that's an amazing story about a politician, about this and that. It's like, where can I watch this? He's like, in Ireland.
No, if you're
so
in
you
Ireland.
Literally need to get
Ireland's
on the ferry.
Ireland's one of those places that's so, it can be really, like you can affect great change there very quickly. Like say the gay marriage thing, for example. The gay marriage referendum was a huge deal, but it was only able to happen at such speed in Ireland because sometimes once something gets run away, it's just a small town.
Everything
can happen very quickly. So everyone can get on board with an idea
or
fundraise, and that's a beautiful thing. The bad part of it is that it can be very small-minded and that everyone believes the same thing. It's still 84% Catholic since the last census. It's a very small-minded place in a lot of ways. And with that, we're like, sure, we'll make our own stuff for our own people. We won't even have to think to change the references. My friend Emily Heller, who's an American stand-up, was over doing a comedy festival there recently. And there was this VIP magazine left in her hotel room. And VIP is the magazine for Irish celebrities to be on. And it's out every week. And there's only 5 million people in the country. And there's probably been 7 million episodes of the VIP magazine.
Brilliant.
And so how do you even find enough people to fill the pages? Yeah. And she was like, yeah, I was looking at this magazine and I think one woman was in it and she was famous because she'd moved from New York. And that was her angle.
Proper celebrity.
Like that, like in Ireland, just to even be famous is like you did something once. Maybe you were in the background in the news or something like that. And then like in your town, you're a hero. Like you were, you did the, you know, you gave it the flip of the finger
and my dad
a newsreader or something.
And my dad volunteers at a local park and he recently asked me to come and open it. And I said no, because it was that thing of I was like, literally everyone in this town will recognise me more from Tesco's because I've got a big beard and I look weird. They'll just be like, that's the bloke from Tesco's.
Tesco's. He must work at Tesco's.
Yeah, he must work. And that'll be it. It won't be for anything I've done because it's not that kind of town.
You know what's really weird about that Tesco guy? When he was open it, he started rhyming. I'm like, leave it out, mate. Get back to the till.
He was so confused.
We're just trying to open the bloody Tesco's.
But yeah, I was too embarrassed. I was like, I can't do it, Dad. I'll come along. Yeah. I'll watch it all, but I can't be the one to open
and
it.
And there's a loveliness to it. I remember, because sometimes I get annoyed when people think at like a small, I remember I did a McDonald's ad when I was at university. Now that McDonald's ad put me to university, through university.
Yes.
The money it made me at the time was huge and it really helped me out and helped me move to England and stuff like that. So I'll always be grateful for it. But it was me kissing the face off this guy and then finding a euro in his back pocket. And then amazing. I would go with my face and I was going to use that euro for the Euro Saver menu at McDonald's.
Sweet.
Now I knew that that would never get seen by anyone. I was delighted. Cut to a week later, it's on every bus. I'm on the back of every bus in Ireland, and there's only one bus stop in my town.
Oh wow!
And it was on the bus stop. I was there with looking at a euro like it was the best thing I'd ever seen, holding a guy's arse, and that was the only bus stop in our town.
Amazing! And so literally everyone in the town
knew
will have
it was
seen
me
that and will know.
Yes, exactly. And I, someone wrote on it something like "Aisling's a slag" or something, which was a fair enough review for the time, to be fair. And my mother went in that night with J cloth and some Cif and scrubbed it off. I remember every time I went home to the nightclub, no matter how many plays I did up in Dublin with the dramatic theatre company, no matter how many Shakespearean monologues I learned, or I went to Edinburgh with three successful sketch group shows, I was still, every time I went home, they go, "She's loving it." I couldn't get away from it. And I remember being so annoyed about it. But I also remember when I was about 8, there was this woman who'd been in the Leinster Leader newspaper as a model for wedding dresses.
Right.
And she was at a funeral we were at. And myself and my friend Orla couldn't stop staring at her. And she's like, "She's the woman from the Leinster Leader magazine who wore that wedding dress. Oh my God, we are so honoured to even be near her at this funeral. Wait, we'll..." And I remember that moment for all of my life because we were like, there she is in our actual town at an actual funeral that we plebs are at. And that was such a big deal to us then. In our world, it was huge. So I keep on forgetting that, like, once you work more in this world, in this industry, the people you meet and the comedians you meet who might have one time been only people you would have known from TV are suddenly your friends and they're your colleagues, and it all sorts of, you numb to it a little bit.
I think as much as anything, you get to see that they're just people.
Yeah.
And when you're just not get away. To see that, it's this behind, it's literally behind plastic. And
yeah, exactly.
It's that thing that you do go, "Oh, right, that's just a regular person." It shouldn't
Most
be that exciting.
Most people are like that. And then, say, Jimmy Carr has these house parties.
Yeah.
And I turned up early to one recently. And I'm never early to anything. And I'm like, "Hiya, Jimmy. There you go. There's a bottle for you." He's like, sure. "Come into the kitchen. No problem. There's a few people in there already." And I'm like, great. I go into the table and Stephen Hawkins is inside sitting at the table. Obviously, he was sitting at the table.
Yeah.
But I was like, "Oh, my God. There's him at a house party."
Yeah, that's a good impression.
That wasn't supposed to be, can I just say, for clarification, that was not my impression of him. He does not speak as fast as he does in the Specsavers adverts.
Excellent.
Little celeb scoop for you there.
Yep,
but couldn't believe he was there. And that's the sort of, there are certain times, and everyone at the party was starstruck. And there were a lot of stars at the party. And it did feel like there are still people who create a gasp no matter where they go.
It's that beautiful thing of, fame and celebrity has changed in society now that's a goal, whereas I think, and it's something I want to talk to about your career, because I think you've shown a really interesting route in that, I'm completely on board with fame and celebrity for being famous for doing something well, rather than just famous for being famous, or that goal of being famous. Mm-hmm. And Stephen Hawkins couldn't be a better example.
He's really
famous for just being insanely intelligent.
Yeah.
Again, he's not the most marketable dude. He's not, you know, so you wouldn't have picked, but he's famous because of how brilliant he is. So I can completely understand how another comedian you might look at and go,
I see the journey.
I've got this, I can see that. Whereas he was like, that's
And maybe it's a sort of insane. To be famous at a level where there might be some people in a supermarket who might recognize me. Most people, when they see me, look at me twice and think, is she a primary school teacher from near my house? Like, I've got that sort of primary school teacher look about me. And but in general, maybe you'll know me lots if you know the world I work in, like comedy, or if you've seen something I'm in. But it's rare, especially nowadays, to reach a level where you're in culture.
Yeah.
I also sneaked into, this sounds like a name drop, but I sneaked into Jimmy Kimmel's Emmys party last year. So I was like Sharon Horgan's plus one for her, and she was going to the Emmys, and I went to her party, and then, which I was legally invited to, then everyone was going to Jimmy Kimmel's party, and I was not invited. And I snuck in behind someone.
Brilliant.
Holding an Emmy. And I tried, he was a sort of older man, and I tried to look like his inappropriately young girlfriend.
Fantastic.
And it worked.
No one questions that.
No one questions that in Hollywood. And I really wanted to go back to the bouncers and go, guys, you're doing a terrible job. I just managed to sneak in, but I obviously didn't. But when I went in
and
there, I saw like, this.
You're the girl off the McDonald's.
Yeah.
You ain't meant to be here.
I believe you know my work. I'm loving it. And when I went in, I saw this man I knew really well. And just as I was about to put my hand on his shoulder, I realized that I didn't know him really well. He was John Travolta, but he was in our consciousness, and I was very drunk that I thought I knew him really well. He had that level, and around him was a circle of nothing. So most people were kind of schmoozing and sort of chatting to people, blah, 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 blah. And no one was going near him. And I realized because he was too famous to be anywhere.
There's no,
he could only maybe really hang out with Beyonce or Kanye West.
Yeah.
He's too famous.
Yeah.
And actually I thought, God, there must be a loneliness in that because there was a bit of a disco and I was like, God, I'd say everyone, he'd want to dance given his history. I'm making assumptions. I mean, he also might want to try and put everyone into the lizard spaceship and take us all off to space with the rest of the Scientologists.
But dancing his way.
But he had no one to dance with. And I thought to myself, oh my God, poor old Grease Lightning has no one to dance with because he's too famous to be anywhere.
And it's something
Stephen Hawkins had that same sort of people were afraid to go over him because they had I think all of us at the party, except for Jimmy, he's like, yeah, go over and talk to me. He loves comedy. And I was like, I can't. What if I say something stupid? Like, I wouldn't know what to say to him. And that's rare for me that I wouldn't go, hiya. Are you coming out with any more books? Something lighter next time, Stephen, perhaps, that I can get on board with.
It's fascinating because I dated a girl once.
All right, in LA. Pip.
There was this
no
girl.
Need to go on about it.
and she was quite famous. And at first, I was confused that she had so many friends that were all super famous, but in completely different areas. And then you realise it's because of that. It's because of that you can't often just have those casual night out type hang out with people. So they are all, it was all, Robin Williams was one of her mates, and then one of the guys from Jackass, and then this guy in a band and all this. And it's like, in my mind, I was like, there's no link here. I understand comedians all know each other. I understand bands all know each other. But I think it is, you get to that certain level of fame that they're the people that will approach you. If Brad Pitt was there, he would have strolled straight up to John Travolta and given him a wet willy. And it would have had that casualness. But as you're not Brad Pitt or whatever, you're standing
there. How do you even begin?
It's John Travolta.
I think, especially in comedy, so I'm an actor as well, and you can maybe reach that level as an actor to do that. But in comedy, it's so important not to ever let yourself get to the stage where you can't be outside of it. Because once you can't observe and be an underdog a little bit, you can't do the job anymore. When you become too famous for people to approach or people can't talk to you, you kind of can't do your job anymore.
Yeah, you can't absorb the right inputs.
Yeah, and you have to really watch out for that happening. You have to sort of take maybe a break away from them. This has never happened to me, but I've observed with super famous comedians, they've had to take a break away from being on screen maybe.
Yeah.
Go down to Tesco's a bit, kind of mooch around, and then come back with some. I remember watching actually, like, there's a nice bits to talk about, but in terms of when you become that famous, I remember I was in LA doing some gigs, and Drew Carey came on stage, and he was doing 20 minutes, and that's a long set in LA. People don't do long sets. And the first 15 minutes was really like, hack comedy. Just like, you know, I've heard this joke maybe a million times where, you know, I think gay marriage should come in because gay people have the right to be as miserable as everyone else. Ha-ha.
Yeah,
that classic. Joke has been done God knows how many times. And I was like, God, yeah. He clearly hasn't been down to any gigs lately. He hasn't hung out with my dad. He hasn't hung down with Pip's. He hasn't hung out with Pip's dad. But also he hasn't been to enough gigs to see that that's the angle most people are taking.
Yeah.
And he was doing stuff about kind of almost like stuff about the bus. And we're looking at him thinking, this might be your old, old material because you don't get the bus anymore. Mm. Now, then in the last 5 minutes, he lit up and we all sparked up because he was talking about finding it really weird living in a mansion and having a cleaner. Right. But he was still talking about it from his humble attitude, which he'll never lose. But he talked about, sometimes I have this cleaner come in and there hasn't been any dirt in the house, but I don't want to not pay her wage. And so sometimes, yeah, I have to like pour the champagne on the carpet just so she's something to do. Yeah. And obviously that was a joke, but I was like, finally, that's your truth now. I want to watch your truth.
Yeah.
But it's very hard, especially if you maybe come from, I know there are some very lefty comedians who became very wealthy and then found it hard. How do I still maintain being lefty?
Because that's it, because you do want to hear the truth, but equally you want some kind of relatability.
Yes.
And that can be a tough balance,
with your maybe personality or attitude or something like that.
How did you find LA comedy scene? Because that must be interesting to go to where you haven't got as much
any profile at all.
And going out and doing those gigs, from what I see from the outside, it looks like an amazing scene because it seems like so many people that are dropping
in. It's not an amazing comedy scene, and I'll tell you why. You go to LA when you've made it somewhere else.
Right.
So once you land in there, you're not going there to be really creative and explore. You might do that, but you're not testing things out.
Yeah.
And there are so many comedians there and everyone's at a level trying to make things work. Now, I really like it out there for kind of odd reasons. I kind of went out there when I was nearing 30 for the first time. Mm-hmm. So already I wasn't panicked about being a 20-something girl being really skinny and things and going, because that's how you get treated, especially as an actress.
Yeah.
I also went out with comedy. So in comedy, you just have to be funny. So I knew going into a room, I could be the funniest person in the room. Whether they put me in a show or not, I wouldn't know. But at least I had that on my side and I wasn't trying to pretend to be really young and 20 and go for those parts.
Yeah.
And also, I've nothing to lose by going out there. And
yeah,
it's just such a dream for me. Like, I grew up and just being there, I'm so thankful to even be there.
I completely understand.
And some people go out with a big bag of dreams and go, make me. Whereas I was like, I'm here and I'm happy with that already.
Yeah.
And some people really get their heart broken when it doesn't work out. Whereas I'm a gritty little grafter and I just like being out there. I also went out one time after I'd worked a lot here and I was really tired and a bit sad. I'd come out of a breakup and I was just so happy to be out there and I have a lovely group of friends out there.
Yeah.
And so it did me the world of good being there. And for a lot of people, LA is a hard business town where they are just constant disappointment and rejection. But I've managed to find this lovely little messy community there of people who are like,
that's perfect.
We're grand now. So I do have a very different experience to probably 70% of people who go out there. And I don't make any money out there, but I'm making enough money in the UK to afford to be out there and not make money, which is a real...
Because you're the first person I've heard to say that. And that's my exact experience of LA, of going out there for auditions and stuff. And I said, I'll go out there and I'll be told by numerous people, oh, it's cutthroat area, it's horrible, it's this and that. I have a wonderful time and I get to go up for stuff that's like, how mind-blowing is it that I'm getting to audition for that? And I don't get them and they tell you you're wonderful and all that. But again... Mm. I don't mind being told that. If they mean it or not, it's still a nice day, isn't it?
It would have been a lot harder. I remember I went out as part of a showcase when I was at drama school and I was about 23.
Oh, right.
And I bleached blonde hair and I was a size 12 and I got told to lose weight. And that was me being there for a week and a half. So I really feel so. And I was just an actress then. I didn't do any comedy or stand up.
Yeah.
Because also say last pilot season, which is where you go out and audition for all the new pilots during February and March.
Yeah.
I probably auditioned for 40 things. Now that would have been really lonely if I was just auditioning every day and every person I met during the day was another actor that we were up for the same part and were technically competition. But actually in the evening I go out and I gig. And I'm not, when you're on a bill with lots of people, you're not competing against them. You're making a night together.
Yeah.
And we're all creating and putting ourselves forward.
Yeah,
and
completely.
So you're still getting to have a creative buzz. And I'm very lucky that I now do stand up, that I have that in the evenings to fill my time. And I think one week I made a dollar, literally a dollar from like, they were like, oh my God, we collected lots of money in the bucket tonight. So everyone's getting paid. I'm like, yahoo, here's your dollar. Here's your dollar. Here's your dollar. But it feels like I've got a creative outlet when I'm there, which is very nice.
It feels like a great balance. And I think
I'm also very lucky to be able to afford to do that. And I'm so grateful that the work I get in the UK affords me that.
Yeah, and that's the key there, I think. The people I speak to, because I'm just starting off in the acting world and absolutely adoring it, but again, it's a similar thing. The people I speak to who seem to feel it's this cold, cutthroat, horrible place are the people who don't have anything outside of it. I don't mean that, don't have family. Obviously,
no, but it's
lives,
really hard. But I've got actor friends who can't write, and so they only get to be creative, brilliant actors. They only get to be creative when they're in someone else's thing, and you're always waiting for the telephone to ring.
Yeah, yeah. So it's kind of ideal to be in that situation where you're doing all these different things. And I mean, I think I'd like to know how it's been for you, because often there's a pushback if you are known for comedy or for stand-up, do dramatic stuff. And The Fall was one that I thought was absolutely amazing. I thought it was fantastic. And it took me by surprise, because when you came off on screen, I was like, oh, wow. And I was aware of your comedy. I was a fan of your comedy, but I hadn't seen your dramatic acting. And I thought, well, it's not going to be a comedy character. I've seen the other series.
I used to get some tweets in about The Fall being like, oh, is Jason Manford going to be outside sweeping up outside the hospital and she's a nurse? But I've been a dramatic actor a lot longer than I've been a stand-up, and I've been a writer a lot longer than I've been a stand-up. Right. And people ask me, oh, so you're going to keep up the acting now? And you're like, yes, of course. And would you ever think of writing? You're like, yes, of course. But it just sort of took off. I think I hit a wave of luck when I started out, where people wanted to see more women on TV.
Yeah.
And so I was maybe 5 years ahead of people who didn't get the look I had. And I'm very aware of that.
Right.
There were maybe female comics who couldn't get paid 5 years before me and gave up because they couldn't make money.
Yeah.
And I, starting out, made enough to kind of not, like, I took out a bank loan to not have to work in a pub. Like, I did all that. Like, I've always been a risk taker with my career in a sense, but I still know I'm incredibly lucky to have gotten paid quite early in my career, which enabled me to go, I'm gonna go for this. Like, a lot of people know, like, a 3 or 4 year period into stand-up and they remember the day they quit their job because they can afford to start stand-up. And I was sort of afforded that. I was already, like, working as an actress, which paid for me a little bit as well. Yeah, like, and when I came out of drama school, like, no cash. I took out a bank loan. I worked as promo jobs and bar jobs and restaurants and waitresses and everything. But it not for more than maybe 2 years. And I've had, like, I'd say I have 20 auditions a year now. I used to have maybe 40, and I'd get one of those maximum. And so I'm used to the rejection side of it. And
how do you feel on that? Because again, I'm genuinely, this isn't even the podcast now. This is me. Just because I love auditions. Everyone seems to hate them. I find them absolutely fascinating. But I think it's because I'm fine with rejection.
I listened to a TED talk recently on success. And this woman has interviewed all different types of successful people in all different types of fields.
Yeah.
Not literal fields. but in all sorts of different areas. And she says that the one thing that connects everyone is not talent or luck or what social strata you come from, the colour of your skin, although we'd like to think that, that of course, contributes to things, privilege, etc. But she says the one thing that connects everyone who stays successful is grit. Mm-hmm. And I'm from a very gritty background. Yeah. So I was brought up by a single mother who brought us up on her own.
Yeah.
And she was gritty. And my whole family is gritty and farmers. And if something didn't work out, they do something else. And I've always had, and maybe, I mean, I know Sharon Horgan very well, and she comes from a farming background, and I know the family very well. Mm. And they're gritty as well. And all of the families succeed in their chosen fields because they've a grit and a sort of ability to see the next thing and never. And a bit of it can be a bit negative in that sometimes you don't get to enjoy what you've done because you're always going, I'll do something else as well, though, just in case.
You always
have a just in case head.
Yeah.
And I've seen some people lose their head, get money in for the first time, forget to pay their tax bill and think it's going to last forever.
Yeah.
And the following year, they've no cash and that there isn't a job coming in. They cannot believe it.
Yeah.
They cannot believe. They're like, what? But this was the dream life I was promised.
This is how it was going. Yeah.
Yeah. Or they get really caught up on fame and they're famous for a year and it's gone the next year. And great, and the ability to keep long. For me, I always felt like getting hired twice is the key, not getting hired once. Mm-hmm. Or still be working in 3 years' time. Like, let's just see. And or one series of a show isn't enough, because I've been in something like, I think, 20 pilots of TV shows, maybe 25 right. pilots of TV shows that no one in Britain will ever have seen except for the people in the offices.
Right.
So I know what it's like to fail. And until it's poster of series two on the tube, I don't get overexcited. That's not to say I get negative. I'm just a bit of a realist.
How do you keep... Well, how do you have a truly critical mind on pilots you're doing? Because has it been the case that of all the 25, you've thought at the time, oh, this is brilliant, and then it turns out it's not a cost? Or have there been ones that you're like, yeah, this is all right.
With TV, with theatre, when you do a play, in general, you've a good sense whether it's a good one or a turkey. And I haven't done theatre in quite a long time, but generally, you're sort of there seeing what the audience will see and hear. Yeah. With sometimes there are table reads of things and you're like, oh my God, this is the best thing I've ever written.
Yeah.
And then you watch how it's filmed and the costumes and all the different levels. You're like, oh, I didn't think it would edit together like that. Or that's really odd. Or else you can think something's fine, but you can't see it off the page. And you can't imagine it. Mm-hmm. This is not an example of that, but I remember doing the read-throughs. So I read read-throughs, table read-throughs for a lot of TV shows. You get one or two actors in to play loads of parts that they don't have the big actors for yet. And Toast of London, which is Matt Berry's show. I have never laughed so much. And I felt like I was there at the start of something special.
Yeah.
And Arthur Matthews, who was half of the Father Ted team, and Matt Berry wrote those shows. And it did translate to when they filmed it. But there was still an extra level when they filmed it that I hadn't seen.
I didn't know
how weird the costumes would be and how choppy the edits would be. Yeah. That would give it an extra voice. And what the background of the set would look like. I didn't know if it would look like it exists in the real world, or would it look kind of sketch showy, or how much magical realism there is. But just the words on the page made me laugh like a drain.
Amazing.
And I really thought, ooh, this is going to be special. And it did turn out to be quite special.
And then the pressure is there, exactly that, to translate that onto the screen.
And I was loving being...
If everyone's aware that it's hilarious, there's that pressure of, don't fuck this up. This is brilliant. And now we've got to get that out of this room and onto the screen.
For example, actually, when I was doing The Fall, I never watch anything I'm in. I hate seeing myself on camera. It really makes me paranoid. And I don't think that's a bad thing, because I feel like if the audience are enjoying what you're doing and the director tells you what to do, if I look at my face, I just see all the weird things I'm doing and I don't look at the job anymore and I get too like... Bleh.
Completely. It's understanding that you're a cog.
Yeah, like I think I look like you on stage. I think I'm a man, a white man with a beard.
Yeah.
When I see myself on panel shows with my long, lanky white arms and my Irish accent, I cannot believe that that's what people put on telly.
But that's it. If you're watching it, you'll be so focused on
that.
What's wrong with you, what's wrong.
Yeah. And
the fact is, exactly as you said, if they've said that that's a wrap on that scene, They've got what they need. You've given what they need. It's not your show. It's not your...
It's really lovely in that sense when you work with a director you trust. Because sometimes when you work with a director you don't trust, you're like, you didn't get it. Because I know I didn't get it. And you didn't. I don't trust you at all. Turkeys are coming before
that
Christmas.
That wasn't good. Yeah.
Yeah. But I can't remember what I was saying.
When you were working on The Fall.
Oh, yeah. On The Fall. What was interesting was I genuinely thought I went in, did the part of a nurse. I trained as a nurse for a whole day in Belfast intensive care with real nurses. I really put a lot into being a nurse in that, but I didn't see Jamie being creepy or anything. And only when everyone started going, oh my God, he's going to kill her, did I go, I have to look at this and see what everyone's talking about.
Yeah.
And Alan, the director, who I bloody love, Alan had written the show and directed it, hadn't been telling me that the camera had been doing all these creepy angles with Jamie looking at me as I was washing him and stuff.
Amazing.
And opening his eyes and all this kind of stuff. Like, I knew a little bit, but it was really good because I was kind of getting on with my nursing. Doobie-doobie-doobie-doo. I wonder if I'll ever make the edit. Maybe I'm just an extra.
And he
actually hadn't been telling me that he was using that as a sort of way to as like he was kind of poking in on me like a through the keyhole thing, like through Jamie's eyes, and it was great. I was delighted
he nailed that though, because that's exactly it. It's perfect, because we are all aware of who this character is and how dark they are and how conniving they are and manipulative, but your character isn't particularly meant to be. You're there as a caregiver.
And you're she is a bit weird and religious, and she has a vibe of a sort of maybe slightly creepy nun.
Yeah.
But
I love that. I love that angle of you genuinely not knowing some of the creepiness that was coming across. Mm. I can't remember who it was recently was saying when they're playing a bad guy, they have to believe.
I think it was Jamie. It might have been Jamie. Jamie had that in that when you have to take on a character who's in any way evil, you have to get, you can't just go, I can't believe anyone would ever do this. Yeah. You have to work out why they would.
Yeah.
So why would a woman be nice to a serial murderer? Yeah. Why would a woman be nice? And it's because she thinks that he can be saved.
Mm.
And imagine if you could save him, it would show that people can save and religion can save.
Yeah, completely.
And so that was my thought process behind the character was like,
he's gorgeous as well. Yeah, I mean, I had that as well. I would have been like, come on, look
this hottie, come on, gals.
No way.
You have to forgive a little face like that. So yeah, so that was kind of my thinking behind that.
I love that. I love that. I love that when you did watch it back, you got to see things that you didn't see because you were the character.
Yeah.
The character didn't know that was happening, therefore you didn't know.
But
that's
the difference between TV and say a play or a stand-up where you don't know how they'll edit it. There's so many people coming in. There's sound. There's a camera. There's the director. There's what the other actor is doing when you turn your back.
Yeah.
You don't know the lighting. You don't know how creepy it's looking on camera, or how it's reading. Whereas in a play or in stand-up, it's me and the microphone. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to the audience, I know how it's coming out and I know what got said, and you've total control. And sometimes that can be overwhelming and panicking that you're in control of all of it and there's no one helping you and you're there on your own and the successes are yours and the losses are yours and they're so embarrassing when you die, but also you don't have anyone to share the elation with, but you do own it all, like I did that. That was just me. But with, I do miss the collaborative nature of TV sometimes. If I do too much stand-up for a while, I really miss acting. Like, I have to have a balance or I get a bit stir-crazy in my mind and my soul.
It's interesting. When you are acting then, do you just play completely in the room, in the real world, and have to be, or are you aware of, oh, we're doing my close-up now, or we're doing this angle
now? Yeah, you do. I'm not a Daniel Day sort of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
I love being around a crew. I love, when I'm doing a comedy acting job, there's nothing better than feeling like the cameraman almost shook the camera because you did something funny. Yeah, like I live, I'd be a real tart for a laugh.
Yeah.
Like I'm like, oh, I'm going good at him this time now with this close up. Wait till I get it. There's one cameraman in particular who I've worked with on a couple of jobs, and it gives me such joy to see his shoulders going because his eyeball is covered up with the camera, but you can see the little smirk underneath the eyepiece. And I'm like, oh, I'm gonna do everything to make that continue to happen.
Brilliant.
And then with drama, you have to be really careful not to sort of, I know sometimes, like, Jamie's really good at switching in and out of character, Jamie Dornan. And he also, for a lot of it, was playing a man who was asleep. So he'd be like, ah, yeah, just having a little chat, going, how's your daughter, John? Great. And then he'd go back to sleep. And we'd be having a laugh. And he'd, like, say something to me like, ah, yeah, shut up, you old slut. And I'd be like, Jamie Dornan. And then I'd have to get into character.
Yeah.
And I'd take a take. And I'm like, feck, I gotta, you know, go to the character again.
Yeah.
Like, let me take a second. Where in comedy you want to keep it live and you don't want to do too many takes, because you might kill the comedy either.
It's great to find that motivation, because on stage your motivation is clear. There's an audience there. You're trying to make them laugh. So that could be lost in TV comedy or film comedy. So it's great that you've found your audience in literally the cameraman or the AD or whoever else of going.
Yeah.
He's so that you're still, you're chasing that laugh in that moment rather than it's a long day, it's been going on, let's just get the lines out, let's get this through. You're still got
and
that motivation
drama,
of, I still need to try
and get
there.
You have to really pretend that no one's there. So I just finished this new drama called Hard Sun, and I think it's going to be so, like, this is the thing, you never know, this is a new show.
100%.
Neil Cross wrote it, who wrote Luther, and it's his big new show. I love Luther. I love this script. It's a real page turner, and I rarely read scripts like a book, and I was like, oh my God, what happened next? I was gasping as I read it. And it's this new pre-apocalyptic drama. And that's not giving away anything. I think I'm allowed to say that, yes. And I remember one day we were doing this really tough scene where it was just myself and this other actress in a sitting room, and we were having a really tough chat together, and I was trying to hold back tears. And the cameraman, it was just one day, we were up against it time-wise, and they couldn't get the camera to stop squeaking. And I'm doing this big scene where I have to sort of cry at the end of it. And every time the camera would move, it went, and I supposed to be just the two of us there. Now, the microphones weren't picking up the squeak, but I could hear it. And this camera is a close-up on my face, and I'm trying to pretend there's no one else in the room, and I'm doing a London accent, and I'm trying to get into the emotion of it and imagining what the character must have been going through. And every time I went, it'd go...
Right in your face. It's going.
And there's a man behind the cameraman pulling him back and forward, moving the camera around. And it was just so funny. It felt like such an Alan Partridge-y sort of, what's that movie about the band? Why can't I think of it?
Spinal Tap.
Spinal Tap. It felt like such a Spinal Tap moment.
Yeah.
And you're trying not to laugh
and
get annoyed. And you're trying to... and you're trying to stay in it.
Yeah.
And it's really hard. So in those moments in the drama, you really want to pretend no one else is there. But there's like... If you could turn around and see what I took a picture actually and posted it one night online, like if you could see what's in the background behind like you sitting there just having a glass of wine crying on your own in a drama, and there's 14 people all looking a bit bored because they've had a long day, someone with a clapper, someone with a boom, crouched underneath a coffee table with a sore back because they have to kind of hold the boom up underneath you. So you really have to be able to shut down.
That's
when like you can't be too precious about being like, I must have the room clear and pretend I'm actually in the 1930s.
Yeah.
You go, sometimes you just have to turn up and everyone has a job to do as well.
Yeah.
So I get a little bit, I never mind anyone having their process if it doesn't get in the way of someone else's.
Completely.
I get a little bit suspicious about anything that doesn't allow other people to do their job well. Like if you're like, no one can step in for a check or change the costume.
It can be key to have that boldness at points. The first TV series I did, there was a guy who I was in a lot of scenes with, and one day he really got angry and was like, no, we need to do it this way. And at first I was like, chill out, man. And kind of he seen that. But then you realise... Well, no, and particularly in TV, he's been playing that character for 5 episodes.
Yeah.
And the director of that day was just directing that episode.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of, it suddenly clicked. It's like, oh, no, right. And again, if his character is changing vastly across the episodes, it'll be on him.
Yes,
no one's
going
to go, oh, who directed this particular episode?
But it's also a polite way to say that, though.
Completely.
You have to clear it with your director first that there's your process. Like, you can come across some assholes who are like, why is this still happening?
Yeah.
And it ruins everyone's day. And you're like, there's a chain of command, like in any situation. And I've worked with one or two actors who've really ruined it for everyone else.
Oh, really?
By deciding to throw their weight around rather than, just going, would you mind if I just had 10 minutes alone? Or can we only have 2 people in the room when we do this?
Yeah.
I'm finding it hard to get into character. Because you're right. It will end up their face on the cover of the thing.
Yeah, completely.
But you have to be careful how asshole-y you're allowed to get. And that's the same on even comedy jobs and panel shows.
Because you're the one in the front as well. So
yeah,
you're the
but
one
everyone
that will
else
come across
is still doing
diva.
Their job.
I think an AD has the unwritten authority to be an ass like whenever he needs to. Because he's needing to get things done. He's needing to be that harsher tone, but if you're the talent as such, you can completely
come
across quite quickly.
When you might get angry because if like say for example in a panel show or something, if they're rushing you to get on and you're like, I don't have my jokes written down, you're like, it doesn't matter. You're like, honestly, you're not going to be the one getting tweeted at, and you're not going to be the one who comes across as unfunny, you don't get to say at the end of a show all the reasons.
Here's why this didn't
work as well, but there is still a polite way to do that. And I've seen some people be assholes about it. And I think we have to be very careful that we don't have one rule for some people.
Yeah.
And we are all creative weirdos, etc. But there's a way of doing it without ruining someone else's day. And I've seen people kind of shout at people and stuff like that, where you're like, everyone still has to go to work. And if the end job costs people their mental health because they hate going to work every day, then that's not something
100%, and it's an awareness that normally, no matter how long it is and how stressful it is, when you leave set, there's people who aren't leaving set yet.
My sister, people who
were already there all morning and are going to be there tidying up your trailer and doing all sorts of other shit.
I'm more aware of it because my
sister is... And they're not going to get the, wow, you were amazing in that show. It's just another day at work. Yeah,
I'm more aware. My sister's a costume designer, and I see her leave the house sometimes at 5 a.m. and get back at 9 a.m.
Yeah.
So the actor, who would be me when they arrive, has their costume there, yeah, and she collects the costumes at the end of the day. So no matter how long your day is, as the talent,
that bit longer,
someone else's day is a bit longer. Yeah, 100%. I'm just a bit conscious of sometimes.
And it's good to be conscious of that, though. I think that keeps you honest in that
way. Don't get me wrong. I'm sure I've come across as an absolute wacky bell end at times, but it's no harm like keeping on clocking in with yourself as well. It's very, do you know what it is? It's difficult to know when you don't want to be a rollover.
Mm-hmm.
A walkover rather than a rollover. A rollover is for the lottery.
Yeah.
When someone hasn't won over the weekend. A walkover. You don't want to be a walkover. You do want to like have a level of a way you get treated. And especially, mm-hmm, I think especially as a woman, you should be very careful not to go, no, fine, sorry, that's all right.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's at what point you realise you're being a knobhead. And it's really hard to find the line because people... People throughout history have had to make a bit of trouble to get equal rights or equality. 100%. And I'm sure people have made them feel like they're being difficult.
Yeah.
And in those moments, you're like, no, I'm not being difficult. This situation has put me in this. And mm-hmm. Or when people that sort of calm down, dear, and you're like, oh, am I making trouble? And sometimes you just go, yeah, I'm fucking making trouble. Yeah. Thank you very much, because trouble needs to happen right now for this to work out. Yeah. And I don't give a shit anymore. And then there's times where there can be a politer way to do things.
Yeah, but completely.
It is hard sometimes, I think. Women are a lot of the time maybe to feel like they're being a bit too much trouble, and you're like, oh, imagine if that was trouble.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think if it was either Ryan Reynolds or Chris Pratt recently, I think, mm-hmm, who was talking about their child and said that someone at one point casually, him or his wife, mm-hmm, described their daughter as bossy, and they said, right, we're outruling that word because you wouldn't call a boy,
you go, oh, he's so confident.
Exactly. Yeah. So, I hate it as well. That is absolutely true. It's finding those things where you're like, right, no, I'm not being a diva. A diva's a prime one, because that's a female attached name. Although it will go to men and women now.
Yeah.
That's a diva you'll generally attribute to a woman.
And it's hard as well, because you're doing it for a bigger reason. So you're not doing it when that's where you go, am I doing this to be difficult, or am I doing this for a bigger reason? And you know in your gut it's not right. And it can feel very patronizing, especially if you are ever in a situation where you're invisible and you realize people can't see you and you're not being heard or you're not being seen.
Yeah.
That can be so emotive, and it makes you emotional. And it's really hard to put forward an argument when you're emotional.
Yeah.
And that's the worst thing about... I read this article recently by this black man who was talking about his husband or his wife, and he said he only realized when he realized how black men were portrayed in the media as their opinions being valued less because of the angry black man stereotype, how long he had not valued his wife's opinion.
Right.
And he loves her, he thinks she's a very intelligent woman and all of this, but he's like, I can't believe how long I've mistrusted her emotions, because when I cry about something, it's because someone close to me has died.
Yeah.
So when she comes in crying about someone, a telephone operator being rude, I'm going, you must be crazy, because I only cry when someone's died.
Yeah.
So you're associating that telephone operator being rude as equivocal to someone having died, rather than going, oh, you just cry more than me, and you're getting your emotions out. It doesn't mean you're being less intelligent than me. But sometimes an emotional or a different way of responding, we filter it through our own filters and going, that's ridiculous. So you're being emotional about this, which means you're overreacting. Emotion is overreacting. Women can be more emotional in their arguments, which people think is overreacting. So if a black man is telling you something and he's angry, they're overreacting. I'll wait for him to calm down and then I can get the truth. Whereas a white person or a white man, you might go, oh, now this is the facts. Here are the facts without any emotion around them. So we can actually see what happens.
It gets that blanket escape. It's like, oh, she's being emotional. It's like, right,
why don't you come back and tell me?
There's probably a reason, probably some ration in there. There's probably, but it's all of it. No. I don't have to pay attention to any of it.
Yeah.
Because she's been...
Whereas
she's been
when my friends tell me things through the guise of emotion, my female friends through the guise of emotion, I see the situation. I don't read it as different or weird.
Yeah.
Whereas because everything gets filtered through maybe a white male perspective, health and science and the TV and the news and facts.
Yeah.
That's what we've been told to trust as like option one. Mm-hmm. Anything outside of that, we're like, well, let's just wait and see.
Yeah.
Let's just wait and see.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting because he was really admitting it from his own point of view, but he was admitting it to himself. And that was like quite a big thing. Completely. And sometimes we're like, oh, well, you have to look at situations from only a logical point of view. You can't always take emotion in, but we should. When judges make cases or when they make judgments in courts of law, they should be bringing in an element of emotion plus the law. There should be judgment there. There should be
a balance of the two. It's because of our mistrust in individuals that we have these stupid rules that are blanket and that, well, the law says, I mean, I know you shouldn't. I know it's not technically this, but the law says that you have to go to prison or whatever else. It's like, no, you should be able to go, oh yeah, this is silly.
Wait,
this
does
is
my
silly. Let's look at
here.
This rationally and calmly.
Yeah. So I think that's something that has to maybe change a little bit of how we understand each other's points of views. For example, I was watching Grayson Perry's documentary All Man, which is really fascinating, and I'd recommend everyone to watch it. It's on YouTube, but it's a bit of a scribbly version of the original Channel 4 version, but it's really, really good. And in it is, I always kind of, I'm like, oh, why don't men talk about their emotions the way women do? It'd be so much easier and we'd all get along much better in our relationships. Because suicide is the biggest killer of men under 50 in Britain and Ireland. Why are men not talking about their emotions? And women, there's this stereotype of women as naggy, 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 blah, blah, blah. What we actually do as women is from a very young age, create a vocabulary of analysis about our emotions and talk to each other and describe things and work things out by talking to each other all the time. Mm-hmm. So by the time we get to our 30s, statistically, women kill themselves less. We have this language where we're like, oh, I feel lonely. That's why I'm going out getting drunk every night.
Yeah.
I feel ashamed of something. He made me feel awful. I was bullied at work. I feel really sad. I'm embarrassed about how I behaved last night. We have the language to say that.
Mm-hmm.
Men are taught to go out and kick a ball, go and do something else, go out and play your guitar, don't analyze your feelings with your friends.
Yeah, man
up. So man up. And by the time a lot of men get to their 30s, they might punch a wall and not be able to articulate why they did that.
Yeah, sure.
So I had a boyfriend who used to overreact a lot, and he just didn't have the, and I was like, why does he not just talk about his feelings and say he's stressed out beforehand? He just practically did not have the language and the words and the skill set that I have.
Development and
So by the time I remember he like pulled someone aside at work and like grabbed them really harshly, and afterwards he was feeling so bad about it. And it was because 3 weeks before that, when he was with his friend, if you did a sort of like rewind, he couldn't even say to his friends in the pub, God, I'm stressed out about this. I'm panicking because I'm worried. I feel really vulnerable that this thing at work might not go well. And if it doesn't go well, I might not make enough money for the business and blah, 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 blah. And all of those things, working them out with his friends or his family, would have prevented him getting to a level where the only thing he could do was grab someone in anger.
It's all built up to that. Yeah.
And I think that happens a lot with men. And if we could do anything, it would be instill a skill set of language of how to articulate, I feel angry. Why do you feel angry? I feel angry because of this. And what are you worried about if you get angry? I'm worried I'll hit someone. What does that make you feel? And so you're crying now, and why are you crying? And it's it is very sad, isn't it? And allowing people to stay with their shame and vulnerability, and allowing vulnerability, not only for men to come forward, but for other men and women, when those people come forward to talk, to be open to that, not to go, you'll be grand.
And that's the key as well, though.
How do you receive people?
It's both sides. I watched a documentary recently called The Red Pill, which was a big documentary about a woman who was a feminist who went in to explore the men's rights movement because of some of the negative things that was coming out of it. Then she decided she was. I wasn't a big fan of the documentary. It's an interesting watch.
Yeah.
But the thing that annoyed me was it seemed to pit feminism at odds with the men's rights movement, and in my mind they shouldn't be. In most situations they're fighting together. A lot of the
feminism
men's rights movements
men.
Exactly, a lot of the men's rights thing were saying exactly as you said, that suicide is the biggest killer of men, and it's because men have the pressure to go out and earn, and the pressure to do this and all this. And but my thought was, how's this an anti thing? Feminism wants equality in the workplace so that women are going out to work as
very
well.
And it's interesting and that and movement so because it's so negative for a lot of men. The reason being feminism and the kind of fight for equality for people of different races is trying to achieve something for ourselves that will hopefully benefit everyone. Whereas the fight against those is people attacking. It's outwardly. So that's
sort of panicking at points and not realizing that you're pulling in the same direction. Another one of the big arguments was the inequality in men's rights in custody cases and things like that. And again, it killed me because the fact is, the law is weighted in favour, or no, they painted it as the law is weighted in favour of women. I would argue the law is weighted in favour of primary caregivers. Mm. It just happens that throughout history, women have been the primary caregiver. Now, feminism again wants to push to change that as the default.
Yeah.
That it may be the man that stays at home. Mm. It may be the woman that stays home.
Yeah.
If that was the case, it would level out. So it just felt everything that the men's rights movement were pitting as this isn't fair. It's like, well, women want that changed as well.
Yeah.
Like, women don't want it to be the men's responsibility to go out and earn. That's part of feminism.
You'd
so
love
what
that.
You're saying
honestly,
is,
if women could hand over you having a baby out the hole in your penis, like, we'd do it in a heartbeat. Do not worry.
Exactly.
And I suppose custody cases are an awful example. The reason being, by the time, like, there are no metal detectors in places where people get married. For guns and knives.
Right.
There are in divorce courts.
Yeah.
Because people are at that stage are so disappointed. The hopes and dreams are
such
over
tension,
and it's so sad and the tension. And you have to go through a metal detector
the
in
pressure,
most divorce
the feeling,
courts.
The failure,
and so
everything.
Custody is awful because it's your hopes and your dreams and your loneliness and you're losing your children. And in those situations, God, there's no ideal way. But the
not
ideal
so.
Life you thought is already being broken up. And that's such an emotive place to start to try to find what's wrong with the or how to fix things or how to
and
fix
it's
the quality
an emotive place
by the
for
time
a stranger
there.
To try and come to these solutions as well, because again, not to get hugely into divorce and whatnot, but when I was younger, I thought it's completely unfair that a woman gets however much percentage of a man's earnings, and then you realise that depending on the situation, particularly if children are involved, her career has had to go on hold, and his career has been allowed to grow because she's stayed at home. Therefore, that's completely fair to want that kind of that balancing out and leveling out of that. But it's a fascinating area that it just annoys me that it's seen as if there are odds when really as what spawned me to go onto that was the solution is men and women.
Feminism will help. Women can help reduce the suicide levels
completely
with men. And I really think that. I think if you are a man struggling listening to this podcast, reach out to your female friends. Not to say that your male friends won't be a great support network. I know so many men who have such amazing male friends and talk about their feelings and stuff.
Genuinely,
but
every
reach
male
out to
I know
the women.
That's reached out to a friend has had at least one of their friends responding saying, oh shit, I've gone through this and I didn't reach out. Do you know what I mean? It's like it doesn't have to be a selfish thing. It can be a you're going to help them out, because as soon as you admit it, they'll go,
could I recommend a few things? Male mental health is a big passion of mine.
I've worked with Calm. Are you familiar with Calm? I've worked with Calm for 10
years. Yes, a campaign against living miserably. If you're listening to this podcast, let me recommend two things. One of them are these TED Talks by a woman called Brené Brown. And one of them is on shame and one of them is on vulnerability. And they're the most watched TED Talks out of all of the TED Talks. And they're only like 7 to 10 minutes long. Watch them. And it's indicative of what's going on in society at the moment that the ones that are the most watched are about shame and vulnerability and how much shame we have. And in one of them, she says that she talks a lot about how much women are shamed in the media and our body image and everything. But a man came up to her after one talk she gave and he said, the women in my life would rather see me die than be weak in front of them. They need me to be their tower of strength. Wow. And I think that's a big thing we have to learn as women, that we really need to allow men to be vulnerable and what we might perceive as weak. And foster that we want you to be vulnerable and sad with us and emotional. And that's something that we we want to hear about and we want to listen about, and we're not going to find you less attractive or less sexy or less of a man. And that in many ways will sort of help us culturally if we do that. And women should be trying to help men with that as well, in the mm-hmm. same way women need men to help them with feminism, because a lot of the fight we can't do on our own.
Yeah,
we need the support of our friends to kind of change the what do you watch? Do you watch programs with a lot of women in them? Do you go and mm-hmm. see female comedians? Do you mm-hmm. listen to female musicians? We need men to sort of back us too.
Yeah,
Rob Delaney is an example. Only has female supports for his stand-up tours. Little things like that make a massive difference. They're not big deals, but they kind of make a lot of help. The other thing is Brené Brown's book, which I'm just like telling everyone about at the moment. And the ironic thing about it is it's sort of an embarrassing cover and title.
Right.
So for a book about shame and owning your own shame, it's a sort of embarrassing book to walk around with, because it's called The Gifts of Imperfection. Being yourself and not trying to be anyone else, something like that.
Yeah,
but it also like has a dove on the front of it.
Amazing.
And it's a little bit kind of like, I'm working on myself when you're carrying it around.
Yeah.
But there's so much in it about shame and vulnerability and allowing yourself to be vulnerable instead of like fighting against it by trying to get your power back when you feel vulnerable or trying to appease people when you get vulnerable, or running away and just being silent on your own and trying to run away from it by like owning your vulnerability, admitting things are sad and you feel awful in that moment and acknowledging why.
Yeah.
And it's just so, it's quite like American Lady self-help booky, but there's an audio version of it as well. But it is, God, it's kind of changed in the last couple of weeks. I've been reading it. It's really changed how I've seen everything. Like,
amazing.
Even us having this chat, sometimes I'd feel under pressure on a podcast to go, God, I better be funny every 2 minutes, or someone might listen to it and not think I'm funny. And if you don't from this podcast, then like the world doesn't crumble around me. But you also might have said something that meant something. Like, if you want to see me be funny, just come and maybe watch my stand up. And there's still no guarantee that night I'll be funny. But allowing yourself to be vulnerable can be so much truer and more powerful sometimes than, and also you can get your funny back at the end. So if you're in the pub with someone and you just have 5 minutes of a real chat, don't worry, you can still have a pint at the end of it. You're not ruining the whole night with your friends. You're not being a downer. You can, people don't mind you being, and actually it's the way you make real friends and real connections when you do that,
and
rather than 70 fake friends you always have a laugh with.
Part of the joy of doing this podcast for almost 3 years now has been sitting down often with people I know well and having conversations we wouldn't have naturally had in the pub, and learning about their past or their vulnerabilities or their fears or anything else. Because as men in particular, you will generally sit down and catch up on what's happened that week.
Yes.
So that's 1 week. Like, we've been alive years.
Whereas women tend to go, how's your week? Great. Oh my God, have you ever had your heart broken open so wide that you thought you'd never live again? Yes. Let me tell you 7 stories from my childhood.
Exactly.
And so we're already building up the language to do that. Yeah. We're like, oh my God, do you think that's why you reacted really badly last week? It probably is. It's something from my childhood. I know what it is. Oh my God, now we fixed that. Great. Do you want a cup of tea? Yes.
And breaking it down and having these conversations. I mean, I've had far more of my male guests at the end say that it felt like a therapy session.
Yeah.
Because it's unusual. So for speaking to a female guests, not to stereotype, but it's probably more of a regular conversation.
Because
we're allowed to go there. Whereas I remember I did a two-part, I think, with Stephen Graham, and we're really close. And at the end of it, he was like, man, there's so much about his career he hadn't realised. Because he'd been tricked into kind of thinking he's the working class, blacked his way in. And he's like, well, no, he went to still a very working class, but a working class theatre group.
Yeah.
And he came from stage. He wasn't just plucked out of nowhere. Mm. He did years on and things like that. And he was like, man, I didn't realise I deserve all of this.
Analysing your feelings and talking about them is, you sort of, it's like kind of combing through your hair.
Yeah.
And each time you comb, you get another knot out.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what opening up does. And sometimes you can let it go too far where you realize there's so many knots in your hair, you wouldn't even know where to start and you feel like the comb would get stuck.
Yeah.
But honestly, little by little, and that's where things can feel overwhelming and you don't even know where to start. And it can feel so hard to open up because you feel like if you open up, everything might fall out.
Yeah.
And you might never get it back in again.
Yeah.
But just if you can start in little ways in your chats with people, maybe before you go into pleasantries, ask about their family. Just ask something really personal and deep, mm-hmm. kind of quickly. You know who's great at that? Brett Goldstein, our great mutual yeah. friend, Brett Goldstein. Yeah. He's like, I can't do small talk, actually, I yeah. can't. And he'll always go straight for like the deepest question you'd ever yeah. had. He's like, I yeah. can't talk about the Rhine.
Yeah.
And sometimes that's like totally weird and he doesn't realize that, Brett, you need to like lovemaking, you need to talk a little bit about the Rhine before you go for the full job.
Yeah.
But there's also something in that because you can actually have vulnerable yeah. deep conversations
there's generally conversations connection. I've had with Brett that I've not had with anyone else yeah. and they weren't. It wasn't like we'd said, I need to talk to someone, man. It's yeah. just been, we've just sat down and that's where mm. it's gone. We've just, that's, it's good to have that in
it's a bit I love about being
general.
A woman and the bit I'd love men to have more and my male friends to have more. I love that about women. Like when things have happened in my life, I've been very sad about or upset about. I've had really, like even during my loneliest, I felt lonely. But I've had maybe 7 people to go to and go, God, yeah. I feel lonely.
Yeah.
And even though that might not fix why I feel lonely in that time,
yeah.
I've had people to go and discuss the potential whys of why I'm feeling that way.
Even if it's few to go, yeah. they didn't help me at all. They
exactly.
don't know me.
Yeah.
They don't know what's inside.
Well, what
still
might have taken someone else 5 years to work out, I get yeah. to work out in 3 months. So it's yeah, not yeah, necessarily yeah. like I don't feel sad and very down, but I can make choices or get book recommendations or whatever it is. Yeah. And there's no shame or judgment when sort of women do that with each other. Whereas yeah. like if you were to go to a male friend, can you recommend any self-help books on loneliness and the soul? You're probably going to be like, mate, no. Like when yeah. does that happen in
yeah,
a large
yeah,
people
yeah,
lad?
Exactly.
Like I hope it happens. I hope people are like, you're stereotyping men. This happens all the time. I really hope it is. But
again, it should, it's, mm-hmm. because on the podcast I've talked to a lot of people about depression and stuff like that, mm-hmm. I feel really lucky that I am someone that appoints my mates are more comfortable to come to
yeah.
because of that, because I've talked to a lot of people about mm-hmm. it doesn't feel as weird, but it shouldn't take that.
But it happens slowly but surely. It's like you don't start eating vegetables when you're in hospital.
Yeah.
You start doing it well beforehand to look after your health.
Yeah,
and I
exactly.
think men are definitely encouraged to look after their outside, maybe sometimes more than women, in that like women are judged by their outside, but men are yep. encouraged to sort of like go to the gym or look a certain way or look funny or look whatever it is. But they're not given in schools and growing up. This is what you do when you're sad. This is what you do when you're lonely. This is yeah. like how you look after your mind and your soul.
Yeah.
How do you create a community of people you can go and talk to? And I'm not saying that women don't get lonely and that there aren't awful situations that happen with a lot of girls as well. But I feel like if you started, it could happen very quickly as a lady. And maybe as a man, it takes a bit more hard work and maybe we need to be conscious of it more. And also, yeah. if a man opens up to a girl, just make sure you never laugh or you never... Like, it'll take a bit longer. And that's what I didn't really realize. I was like, if I talk to a man about my feelings, why does he not talk about his feelings the exact same way back? Couldn't yeah. understand it. Until I watched that Grace and Perry documentary, I was like, oh, because it happens at a different pace and I can't expect him to come back at me with the exact same way I can, or expect him not to feel overwhelmed by a lot of my stuff coming at him.
Yeah.
Because if I throw too much stuff at someone who doesn't talk about their feeling lows, it's a lot of blood. It's 17 emotions.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it's he's only getting through yeah. one, you know.
Yeah,
and I'm
yeah,
like, completely. I have 17 before I get to sleep at night and I'll have to talk about them all.
Yeah, let's get this all off my chest.
Yeah, I need to get this all off my chest. It took 85 minutes, but it's going to be a lot. And they're like, oh, fucking hell, I just want to like go to sleep right now and maybe think about one while I go to sleep. Yeah. Anger is currently the one I have.
Yeah. Anger and annoyance.
Talk to me about it. Tell me about your anger.
Well, we're at the 70-minute mark. So, it flies by, doesn't it? So we'll start to wrap things up. But let's, at the end, I want to talk about something that's... I'm sure you've never been asked about, but women on panel shows. I'm genuinely not going that route. but it is kind of a topic I want to discuss with you because it is something I think it's something that shouldn't be overlooked. The rarity of the opportunity to be a host as a female on the panel mm-hmm. show, and then to excel at it as well. Do you know what I mean?
With
8 out of 10 cats, with Sean and John doing so well mm-hmm. for so long, whoever took over, I'm a fan of you and of Rob.
Mm-hmm.
Yet I was still, I love Sean and John.
I
had them recorded for ages, and then I didn't watch them for a while. And then I put one on, and I was slayed. And then I'd just smash through all of them. And it was like,
well, it's a different show. Massive... It's just a new show.
Yeah, completely.
Here's the thing. People always want more women on panel shows, more women on panel shows. I have done maybe genuinely 50 panel shows now.
Yeah.
Maybe even more. I couldn't even tell you how many.
It's an interesting one, as you said, on the timing.
League of Their Own, 8 out of 10 cats, big fat quiz.
The timing of when you were blowing up was when there was this kind of push.
But you know what's never happened? Mm. No one has ever come to me. I think one person came to Sarah Pascoe and said, hey, women find them hard. What can we do? So people tend to throw women into environments without checking what about the environment makes it difficult.
Yep.
And I can imagine this happens in other workforces. And that doesn't take ages to fix. Mm. And I could tell you, oh, do you know what? Where you put the chair, where you put me near to the host. If there are five male voices speaking at a loud register and you put me the furthest away from the male host who has to shout to try and hear me or speak to me.
Yeah.
That's not going to help me in that male environment.
Yeah,
if you have another female comedian on the show and you put her on the other team to balance it out looks wise rather than put her beside me, and we've got a language that already works, that's not going to help me. And no, I've had to fight for those things and say them all the time. And
simple,
it's boring.
And logical things.
And simple and logical things.
It shouldn't even be necessarily a subject of male or female.
Making me feel weaker, it's just helping the situation out.
Yeah.
And that's how you kind of equal things out. And the more female, it's not more female guests on a show, it's more female comedians.
100%. Because again, when there was that big push, there was a lot of, it didn't help the situation.
I witnessed it.
That women were put in the slot that weren't necessarily, this is going to sound horrible, but weren't ready to be in that slot, or weren't comedians, as said, were just
female guests. And also,
therefore, you're going to have loads of blokes going, oh, women aren't. A woman and never funny on
but
these shows.
But also, if you have a female guest, so if you come from a farming background and you get into government, you might not prioritise the city buses.
Yeah.
You might be thinking of the farming because that's your first point of view. Yeah. It's the same like if you have a friend who looks like you and sounds like you, you're probably going to see them first.
Yeah.
That's why diversity is really important on panel shows, because you get a lot of different voices and people kind of looking out for each other in different ways. If you've all white men talking about the same thing, that's not diversity. It's just a load of stand-ups doing their routines.
Yeah.
Also, in testosterone-driven cultures, testosterone is one of those hormones that fuels more testosterone.
Yeah.
So testosterone-driven cultures where there are mostly males at the top tend to be more warlike. Estrogen quells testosterone.
Right.
So estrogen, so you put a couple of women in a workforce or in a warlike country and everything quells down.
Yeah.
And it's better for men's mental health. And I say this a lot. On the panel shows where I fought for at least 50-50, so all of the last series of 8 out of 10 cats was 50-50 women. Female guests and female comedians. It's not enough just to have all female guests, you need female comedians as well.
Completely.
Everyone had, when there are more women on a panel show than men, everyone has a good show.
Yeah.
When there's a few women, a few people have a good show because the testosterone drives everyone to sort of be competitive. And I've come off stage after those shows. No one really feels happy. The person who did really well, or the two people who did really well, might feel like, yeah, cool, man. Yeah, it was a good show. It was a good show. It was a good show.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily feel it was a good show for everyone. They're just like, I got through it.
Yeah.
Whereas the shows, I've seen everyone light up.
Yeah.
And everyone just make way for each other when there are more women on shows, and everyone gets to be funny. And those ones, people like wonder, oh, what was it? I can tell you what it is. I've sat there. Nobody except myself and Catherine Ryan has actually ever been a captain. She was on Bring the Noise, which was a Sky music show, and me on Cats. And no one ever comes and asks us. No one ever comes and asks, what can we do to fix this or help this? Everyone just goes, oh, we're a great show and we're a great show for women. Don't worry about it. We're actually really pro women here. No one actually ever comes and asks. And I'm like, and I, and is, are people going around asking black comedians what we could do to change how many black people get on TV? Are people actually going around to black writers going, what's the problem with writing on TV?
Yeah.
Are people actually going and asking people from the diversity quotas that they need how to change stuff? Are people, like Riz Ahmed gave a really great speech recently, I think it was at BAFTAs or something, about how the industry could be changed.
Yeah.
And people are now inviting like Riz and Idris Elba to go and talk. And they're going, oh yeah, we'll take tips from you. Good. You should take tips from the people
that's
you want
exactly
in.
Exactly who you should be taking
because
tips from.
Because we know, and we're the experienced ones, knowing how hard it is. So
but again, I guess it's another one where it's sadly it's it's going to be a gradual thing. It's going to be, the first step is going, oh, we're going to have more women. The next step is going, you need more than that. You don't just need token. No one wants to be a token on a show.
But we also need to know that that effort is for the greater good.
Yeah, 100%.
You're not having to do it. It's not like you're having to sit beside the single old uncle at a wedding. And you're like, I know this is good for the people at the wedding, but it's a real drain on me to have to sit beside the single uncle. You're getting to, it's not a sacrifice that you have to do. It actually helps the greater good and it'll help you.
Completely. And what you were saying there about a positioning and seating and stuff like this, for anyone who's thinking, oh, this is just pushing the feminist agenda on or whatever, it's like, it's not, because literally I've got podcasts bid on the network and we position people, male or female, because I've got a big, loud, booming voice.
Yeah.
So if we've got one mic that's recording the whole room, we put me furthest away from it.
And you put me far away as well. And that's just for the good
of
it.
It's not a case of, oh, we need to look after the women. It's like, no, it's to make it flow better.
Yeah,
it's not
exactly.
We're not looking after anyone when we do that in our one mic podcast. We're looking after the quality of the show, the flow of the show. Yeah. So everyone is getting their interaction in and no one's feeling pushed out. So, yeah. Yeah, I said, the only reason I wanted to
little
even touch
like
upon
that
was the fact, as you said, the captain element probably has given you that power, and turns out it has to make some of those changes and be more conscious of that and make it a welcoming and exciting and engaging environment.
Cheryl,
I remember when
Sandberg,
I had Sarah Pascoe on, and she was saying that she didn't enjoy doing panel shows. And it was exactly that. At that point, it was probably two years ago now, she had just done one and came back, she said, fucking hard. I didn't enjoy it at all. I'd rather be going and doing my stand-up and doing my gig.
Cheryl Sandberg, who is the CEO of Facebook, so she wrote that book Lean In, which is amazing, said that until she got pregnant, and she was the head of Facebook with Mark Zuckerberg, until she got pregnant, she didn't realise how boring it was to have to park really far away, that there were no disabled car parking spaces for pregnant women.
Yeah.
And she's like, it makes such a difference in the day to just... so you don't have to waddle in across a car park, just nearer to the door. And she said, I'd never thought of like little things. That's not meaning that women are weaker. It's just during that time, it's just easier. Did you see Hidden Figures, for example?
I haven't seen
Hidden
it yet,
Figures is an amazing movie and it's really heartwarming. And it's about these three black female scientists at NASA when they were trying to get a spaceship up into the moon. And they had to, on top of doing all their mathematician work, they had to run like ages to go to the bathroom every day to go to the black person's bathroom. And until the boss said, Jesus, I'm going to put in bathrooms here and make just everyone's bathroom near enough. They were doing that on top of everything else. And just, it's like conscientiousness that you're not giving away anything by doing that. You're just making it a bit easier for people to do their job.
Yeah, completely.
In the same way a disability ramp isn't getting
benefits,
in the way of
like you.
You
could look at it completely selfishly. You're going to get better work rates. Yeah. You're going to get better shows if it's a warm and engaging environment where
it's like people are like, oh,
themselves.
I don't want to have to pay more tax so that poor people get an opportunity. You're like, yeah, I'll pay a bit more tax if that helps them, because then I live in the society where people are helped a bit more, which will be happy. We have to sort of,
it's nicer and friendlier, and it's not this constant tension.
I think we've got a real scarcity thing in society, that we're all getting really scared that there's a scarcity about what we have, that we're all going to lose something.
Yeah.
But if we give anything away, we're going to lose something.
Yeah.
Without sort of having faith that it'll all be fine. We're so scared. We're so scared that an immigrant might take our job or something might. And, you know, and those fears can be real, and I understand them. But if we become okay, if we get rid of scarcity, how much of what I'm thinking is a fear of scarcity?
I put so much of it down to increasing level of forgetfulness in society that is literally, it's unimaginable, these things. But it's like, well, it was literally 5 years ago that we didn't have smartphones or whatever, or 10, 15 years ago, or whatever it is, or 20 years ago, we didn't have the internet and stuff like that. So all of these things, you're like, I don't want to lose this. It's like, you'll be fine if you lose a little bit. Like, you can lose
can
a little bit. If you remember, you were fine 10 years ago. So all the things you've had since then, you'll be all right if you lose a little bit. It's going to be fine. Well, thank you very much. Where can people keep up to date on everything that you're doing?
I'm really bad at updating my website, but I have to. I really have to start updating it. I just find it a really boring task. Like it ends up on my to-do list. It's made it, it update my website has transferred to I think 7 to-do lists now. Different.
I swear, it's why social media is so popular because you don't have to.
Yeah, you just do it quickly.
You just do stuff. Yeah. Here you go. There's what's going on. 140
characters.
Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose Twitter. Yep. At We Miss B, WeeMissBea. So there, Instagram, also We Miss B. If you want to see probably overly filtered photos of my face, that's where. If you want to send me penis photos, then by all means.
Oh, great.
Please
so that's
don't.
Instagram.
Instagram would be preferential for that because they kind of blur them out.
Yeah.
When they come into the, the Facebook ones, they really don't blur this. Them out.
They
you know,
stuff,
yeah, they just
they?
They just come in there. but please don't do that.
Don't.
Pip.
Yep. Okay.
There's Pip's lad. He
message
does that a bit
got.
Literally. Okay. Message you got. I have to come on your podcast to ask you to stop doing that.
Yeah. You should come on my podcast. Okay. I'm
just
coming.
I'm not a nurse and I don't know what it is.
Well, okay. I'll find someone who can solve that problem. Thank you very much for coming on and thank
you
for
so
welcoming
much.
Me into your living room.
Scroobius Pip, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. That was Aisling B. Thoroughly lovely and enjoyable conversation. I think she's absolutely amazing. I love her free-ranging stroll from drama to comedy to anything she wants and absolutely smashing it on all accounts. So, yeah, a really good chat. On next week's podcast, I've got Will Poulter, who's in Detroit. Which is a movie that's out now. Even ahead of the podcast, I urge you to go and see that ASAP. It's a very powerful and amazing film. It's about an incident that happened during the riots in Detroit in 62, I want to say. I went to a preview of it the other day. It's absolutely amazing. It's John Boyega's in it. It's fantastic. I can't speak highly enough of it. And aside from it being an amazing film, I really want people to go and see it in the cinema because the greater the box office, the greater the support for more films are like this, telling important stories, rather than just superhero films and so on and so forth, which you all know I love and adore. But we've got tons of them. So the more, I mean, this film is already looking like being one of the big box office smashes of the summer. So the more people that get out there and see this in the cinema. Also, it's set in Detroit in the 60s. So the soundtrack is Motown Heaven. So it's definitely worth catching on the big screen in a big system, on a big system. So yeah, Will's on next week. And then we've got a load of amazing guests. I won't go into too much detail because the next 2 weeks' guests I haven't recorded yet. But I've confirmed them, but there's always a risk. So yeah, I've got 3 confirmed that I haven't recorded yet that are fantastic. And I've got a couple more recorded. And there'll be the live one. There's a lot to come, basically, ladies and gentlemen, a lot to look forward to. Thank you for tuning in. Again, my Scroobius Pip times OHW shoes out now. Come and check us out. They're amazing. I'll see you all next week. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.